All right. As you're getting settled, counsel, I'll just remind you, as I'm sure you know, that you both have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and Repellent will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please begin your arguments by identifying yourself for us. And with that, we'll call the next case on the calendar, A19-0272, State of Minnesota versus Kent David Olson. Counsel for Appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Melissa Haley. I'm an assistant appellate public defender for Kent Olson, the appellant in this matter. And we have three issues that we've raised before you. One is the insufficiency argument for a burglary first-degree charge out of Carlton County. And then there's two evidentiary issues that we also raise in the brief. I'd like to start by discussing the sufficiency argument in this case. This is the circumstances proved in this case are that Mr. Olson was found on January 5th, 2018, the day after the burglary occurred, with a buck knife and a cell phone belonging to the homeowner in his possession. He was arrested at the Black Bear Casino in Carlton, Minnesota. The burglary happened in Cloquet, Minnesota. And when he was arrested on an unrelated charge, he had pockets full of possessions, including five cell phones and other knives. And on the desk or the chair next to him when he was arrested, he had all sorts of other possessions as well. The other circumstances proved...
Is there any evidence as to whose possessions, whether those were owned by somebody else?
No.
Okay.
The other circumstances proved are that he was wearing some jeans, black boots, a black hat, ski mask, presumably rolled up as a hat on his head, and a black leather jacket when he was arrested the next day at Black Bear Casino. The officer who arrested him had seen him the day before, so the day of the burglary, January 4th, at about 4:15 in the afternoon. And that officer testified that he was wearing the same clothes, so the jeans, the black boots, and the black leather jacket and the rolled-up hat at that time. There was evidence in the record that he fled from the officer when he saw him on January 4th, over 3 hours before the burglary, before this case occurred. And it is those circumstances at which, as you're looking at an independent review in the record, we're arguing that the state hasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Olson entered that house and committed that burglary. I cited a case in my brief called Ward versus Lockhart that is very instructive on this set of circumstances. It's a case out of the Eighth Circuit. It was a petition for habeas relief, actually, interestingly, a pro se petition. The Arkansas courts had upheld a burglary conviction prior to that point on circumstantial evidence. The defendant in that case, or the petitioner in that case, had been found at a pawn shop in possession of musical instruments that had been stolen a couple days before from a junior high school.
But it was only a couple of them. It wasn't all of the instruments, was it, counsel?
It was only a couple of instruments, that's true. But I think that the relevant piece there was that when that petitioner was questioned about it, he fled from police on the charge they were investigating. And later, when they were asking him about being at the pawn shop, he was untruthful with the police.
Was he observed prior to that burglary within a couple of blocks and then fled in the direction of the house that he was eventually discovered in? Or he wasn't discovered in any house, correct?
It wasn't a house, it was a school.
Right.
And to answer your question directly, he was not found at all near the school. The pawn shop was somewhere else. And there was a longer period of time in that case as well. It was two days instead of one.
Time, do we? We know what time he was found in the house. We don't know what time he entered the house.
Right.
So, I mean, it could have been very close to the time that the jury could have inferred that, couldn't they? I mean, when the homeowner saw him in the basement at 7 o'clock, that's not necessarily when the burglary occurred, is it, or when the entry to the home?
I think the record was that we don't know when it happened. We don't know when the person entered the home. Mm-hmm. But I think what's important to think about as you're reviewing the record is, did the state, was it a reasonable inference that Mr. Olson was the person who entered the home whenever you decide you think that he entered the home? And I think even without getting into the differences in description and the differences in eye colors and all of that, assuming that we're not even going to look at that, fleeing on a different offense that happened earlier, even if it was in the neighborhood. And we've got Exhibit 18, I think, is an aerial map of the neighborhood and shows you how many houses, how many things are in that neighborhood. And even assuming that Mr. Olson testifies that he was hiding from police on that unrelated offense, the inference that you have to decide that the state showed evidence of that can be made and that shows entry beyond a reasonable doubt is that he necessarily was hiding in that house. And I don't think it's there on this record.
Was his just general testimony, I was hiding? You said he testified that he was hiding.
Yeah, his testimony was pretty specific about hiding at different places outside. And for purposes of your review, I think you assume that they didn't believe his testimony generally. So the circumstance proved is that he'd said he was hiding generally. But I think when you're then looking at what are the reasonable inferences, and when you're looking at the reasonable inferences, you're not deferring to the jury at that point. You're looking at, was it reasonable to think that he necessarily went into that house and hid at that point? And our argument is that it was not, that this is more a situation like Ward versus Lockhart, where there's not enough a link to the particular place that they're talking about. And
also, I'm a little confused, I have to admit here. He's found the next day wearing the same clothes the officer had seen him in. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And on him are the stolen cell phone and buck knife.
Right.
Those were taken from the woman who lived in the house, inside the house, correct?
Right.
Okay. Isn't that pretty damning evidence?
So 12 hours later, in possession, I mean, that's evidence that he was in possession of stolen property. That is a circumstance to consider. But what the court in Ward versus Lockhart said is that possession, and in that case, even that possession with somebody acting guilty, telling them different things and fleeing on that particular charge, is not circumstances to infer entry into the house.
Now, I understand the difference between receiving, and you're right, that's a solid receiving and circumstantial on the burglary. But given the facts that he was seen in this outfit 3 hours before this incident happened with this woman inside her home, in the same general vicinity, and we can argue about eye color or those things like you said, it just seems to me that that's pretty strong circumstantial evidence. I realize it's solid receiving, but I guess I'm trying to really see where the alternative theory is here. Justin, is that our alternative theory?
So I think that likely the jury disregarded the defendant's testimony, right? And when you're looking at the circumstances, and that's where the testimony about Justin came out. So let's, for reasonable alternate theory on this case, you've got the record showing that he was found with multiple cell phones at a location a pretty good distance away from, in a different city from when this occurred. It's reasonable to infer that he got a ride there. It's reasonable to infer, I think, people don't carry five cell phones, that he may have gotten this property from somebody else. And our position is that that is just as reasonable a hypothesis as that Mr. Olson was the person who happened to go into that house to hide.
Doesn't that require the additional inference that he just happened to run into the person who had burglarized the house in the same neighborhood where he was? I mean, under your theory, there's no dispute that he was in the neighborhood at this other home where there was some sort of altercation. That's established, isn't it? I mean, the person who was involved in whatever the incident the police responded to at the other home, There's no dispute that that's the person who was arrested at the casino, isn't it? Is there? I mean, the people in that home identified him.
Right. You mean that my client was the person involved in the dispute over on 10th Avenue?
Right. Where the cops saw him in the driveway next door. There's no dispute that that is the guy who was arrested at the Black Bear Casino.
Right.
So under your theory, he fled, but it's possible that somebody else broke into the home that where the woman was in the basement, but then he somehow would have had to coincidentally meet up with that person. When he got a ride, it would have to happen to have been the person who broke into that other into the home.
Well, either that or that he got it from somebody at the casino or somewhere in between. In those 12 hours, just like in Ward versus Lockhart, there was enough of a break in the chain.
He somehow coincidentally got connected to the neighborhood again. Your theory is that there were two people in the neighborhood. Him and at least one other person who broke into the house.
Right.
Somehow, in the 12 hours that followed him leaving this woman's basement, he happened to run into that person.
Right.
Okay. Or somehow got connected to that person. There could have been intermediaries between that person and him.
Right. So we're asking for reversal on the basis that the circumstances just are not enough to show beyond a reasonable doubt that he was the person that committed the burglary, took the property from the home. Related are the two evidentiary issues, because they really go to the same thing, whether it was reasonable to infer that he was the one that went into the home. And the first one I'll talk about is the fleeing. And I would just say on both of these, the state has raised a standard of review argument. The standard of review is an abuse of discretion, and I'll refer you to the transcript on both of those where it's raised. For the fleeing as consciousness of guilt evidentiary issue, the transcript page 352 to 353 describes the objection to that evidence as prejudicial, as that it implies guilt. The state argued that it was descriptive, relevant, and central to their facts, and the court ruled not on really either of the things that the parties brought before them, but on a case called State versus Givens that is a Court of Appeals case from 1984 that stands for a limited proposition that if you're being arrested on, say, an assault, and the police come to your house and you flee out the back door, that evidence of flight would be admissible in that charge, in that case, to show consciousness of guilt. In this case, that was an error, an abuse of discretion to apply that case, because we're talking about an offense that happened before the charged offense occurred, 3 hours earlier. So it's not relevant in this case.
I understand, but are you suggesting we're limited to the district court's reasoning? I mean, in any event, they cited the wrong reason. If there's another basis that supports the decision the district court made on an abuse of discretion standard, can't we consider that?
Well, what I'm saying is the issue is really about whether or not that evidence was prejudicial. And that...
Now, which evidence are you talking about?
The evidence
that he fled?
Right. The characterizing the running from police as flight, as fleeing.
Well, how would they have introduced any of their evidence about searching if they couldn't say why they were searching?
They were talking about the investigation of the disturbance. And the specific motion that the defense made in this case was that you shouldn't characterize the running from the police as flight, and because it would be prejudicial, too prejudicial. Even assuming that it's relevant under some standard, some other standard or some other theory, it's too prejudicial that they'll presume guilt. And our position is that is exactly what they did in this case, as evidenced by the fact that it's the state's theory. It's pervasive from the opening statement through cross-examination and again in closing arguments that this was the type of person that would flee from the police. He was fleeing from him, so therefore he must have gone into the basement to conceal himself and to get away with it.
I don't understand how could any of the evidence about why the police were searching the neighborhood get introduced without saying they were looking for him? I mean, could they somehow say they were just looking for him? Why would they be looking for him?
Well, they would. So the trial court ruled and did a good job of trying to limit the context of how they talked about that disturbance, right? They referred to it as a disturbance instead of a domestic. They said we aren't otherwise going to get into the criminal conduct of it. But this motion specifically was to not characterize it as fleeing, which is a separate criminal offense. So they could have said he ran. They could have said, they still could have said they were looking for him. It wouldn't have been so prejudicial if they couldn't call it fleeing. Right, term fleeing and the extrapolation from there. The number of times they used the word fled, the talk in the closing argument of that he's the type of person to do this was prejudicial. I will leave the last topic, which is impeachment, to the briefs, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Haley. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. With respect to that, the first issue, as pointed out in the brief, the black pants, the discrepancy with the clothing, the black pants is not part of the circumstances proved because officer, or I think it's Schneeberger, I can't remember if he's an officer or a deputy, testified that when he spoke with the victim, KK, when the crime was reported, that she told him that the person in the basement was wearing jeans. So is there a discrepancy because she later testified that the person in the basement was wearing black pants? Yeah, that's a discrepancy, but obviously the jury resolved that discrepancy in favor of the verdict, and so the court has to go with the description of jeans, which places
what
under
about the discrepancy with jackets? Didn't the cop who saw him in the driveway say he was wearing a black leather jacket?
Yep, and he was found wearing that as well.
But the woman in the basement testified that he was wearing some other kind of jacket.
Yes, a tannish green or greenish tan, a military type jacket. But that's one discrepancy, but obviously the district court, or the jury, looked at all the evidence and just resolved that as she was incorrect. She's based on her age, I believe her date of birth was in 1941, so she's in her 70s. She admitted on her stand that she had problems with her eyesight. She's obviously under a lot of stress. I don't think that's a, certainly doesn't get a new trial for defendant here based on that fact alone.
Counsel, I'd like to address an issue Ms. Haley didn't get to, and that is the introduction of the three felonies on top of the two that had been agreed on. I'm looking back at defense counsel who said she could have more artfully asked the question of her client regarding the two felonies. And you know, you think about how you would structure that question now that you've agreed to only allow in two, and you think you could ask it in various ways, but the gist of it is you're asking your client, you have two prior felonies, don't you? I mean, you're not going to say more than that because the agreement is two. It appears to me, and I'm speaking just for myself here, that the district court here abused its discretion when it allowed in those three more. Two was all the jury was going to hear about in any case because that was the agreement. So when he said two, yes, he had more, but two was the agreement. How, I mean, I think the court allowed it in impeachment through contradiction, but because you didn't do a 609 analysis. But that is very damning testimony to throw in three more at the end. When a jury is sitting there, now they hear he's got not just two felonies, he's got five, and he tried to conceal three. It looked like a real gotcha to me, and I think the court made a mistake. What's your response?
Well, there's a couple of things to that. Yes, the question was inartfully asked, and
Let me stop you. How would you have asked it? Your client's up there, and there's only two felonies going in. You can't say you have two felonies, right? Because he's got more. Do you say you have two felonies you're going to tell us about today? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's not an easy question. If you want to be the lawyer who, and defense lawyers are taught to do that, of course, you want to defuse it before the prosecutor asks about it.
Correct.
So you've got to bring it out, and the question is, how do you bring that out without appearing to be concealing? So, anyhow.
Was there a misstatement of fact? That's what the district court found. It said, was there a misstatement of fact? Yes, there was. And under the case law, either it's an unfair advantage or a misstatement of fact. I can agree with the court. This is a close call, and this isn't a hill I want to die on this argument, because at the end of the day, there was no description of what those other felonies were. He's got the two felonies, and in the argument that the state made to the jury, the prosecutor made a general argument about credibility and asked the jury to look at numerous factors, one of which was impeachment. But on the facts in front of the jury,
the jury never learned about the agreement to only introduce evidence of two. And then the jury had no reason for understanding what was really going on here.
On redirect, defense counsel asked him, why did you say two? And his response was, because that's what I was told I could say. So it was cleaned up, and I think the prejudice from it was minimized, especially when you look at the rest of the stuff that undermined appellant's credibility on the stand. This whole explanation about how he came to have the cell phone and the knife. And the idea that KK said it was 25 below, appellant said it was 30 below. The fact that he was outside in a black leather jacket, jeans, a balaclava, and was outside for 5 hours hiding. I think he said he was hiding in between a house and some kind of delivery truck. I think the good people of Cloquet could discount that he could have reasonably survived that and walked away without any kind of medical problems. I think the obvious inference is he couldn't have done that, so he did what anyone else would do. I'm getting away, and I have to get to ground right now. As I point out in the brief, there's anywhere between 5 and 6 squad cars that are immediately on the scene. And given that it's 25 and 30 below outside, there aren't a lot of people outside. The police run into, I believe, 2 groups of people and maybe a smattering of other people who are out shoveling or doing other things. But apart from that, there's very few people running around. The police officers are there on that scene for over an hour, and no one sees anybody wearing a black leather jacket or fitting the description of appellant who has just run away. He just disappeared into thin air, and I think the jury was able to look at that testimony from the appellant and simply discount it. The fact that there are 5 felonies as opposed to 2 felonies, I think that really is a added grains to the scale that were balanced against him, and I don't think under the standard of review he's entitled to a new trial for that. Ward v. Lockhart, I just want to get back to the first issue. Ward v. Lockhart, if you read the decision, it's clear that it's based on the fact that there is no evidence tying the person who's found at the pawn shop to the burglary at the junior high school. Here, as we've discussed, there's plenty of evidence that ties appellant to the vicinity and ties him to the basement. With respect to the second issue, the fleeing part of it, counsel says this is the type of person who would flee, that is what the evidence was introduced for, and that makes it sound like it's propensity evidence, that he's prone to fleeing. That is not what the state introduced it for at all, and the state made it clear. This evidence doesn't show a propensity to flee in the direction of the victim's home. It places him there, actually fleeing in the direction of the home. So there's no propensity evidence. It's immediate episode evidence. It places him at the scene with an opportunity to break into the victim's homes and thereafter commit the burglary. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. Otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson.
Thank you.
Ms. Haley, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about the impeachment issue. But before I get that, I'm going to reply briefly to this idea of immediate episode evidence. That's a very, very narrow exception to...
From a relevancy standpoint, doesn't evidence showing a person in the vicinity of and running toward, closer to, or in the direction of the location of the crime, doesn't that make that more likely true than not in terms of analyzing it from an evidentiary standpoint? It just seems to me that it's part of the evidence in the case. Puts him in the vicinity, gives him an opportunity to commit the crime as he's been charged.
Right.
And why shouldn't the state be able to prove that?
The state ought to be able to prove the relevant facts of the case on the cases that talk about immediate episode evidence and when courts are letting that in. There is both a time
that it was that the person they've charged is the person that committed it, and so they're trying to put them in the vicinity of the crime. How is that not relevant?
Right. We're not saying they can't put them in the vicinity. They can put them in the vicinity. We're saying fleeing is not itself immediate episode evidence, and because there's not a time and cause, not a causal connection between fleeing and the burglary. What the state was relevant for the state to prove on this particular charge was what you're saying, that he was in the vicinity, not that he was fleeing.
The testimony was, hey, he just ran off, and the officer testified, yeah, he ran off in the direction of the victim's home.
Yes.
Would that have been okay?
That would have been okay. I'm going to move on to impeachment because I didn't get to talk about it before, and it sounds like you're interested in that topic. The State versus Valteria case, the Supreme Court case that I cited in there, that talks a lot about why courts should always be cautious with the opening the door and not move beyond facts that are at issue in the case in applying that, and to be particularly cautious in the context of impeachment because it can have a chilling effect on the defendant's right or their ability to exercise their right to testify in the case. And I would submit that not only was this an abuse of discretion to apply that in this context and to let the additional three decayed felonies in without any 609 or Jones balancing to determine the prejudice and whether the probative value was or the prejudice substantially outweighed the probative value. But that it wasn't just three felony convictions that the jury, it was that the state was able to then paint Mr. Olson as somebody who was untruthful, who was lying, and then the jury disregarded his testimony. And so when I'm here talking to you about the circumstances proved and whether he's, whether the inference was that he actually entered the place, the jury has disregarded that there was another person that he got information to and that it would explain his possession of those items that were taken from the home. So the prejudice here is very evident from the record. I think if you look at the state's closing argument with these, you'll see that these three issues are intertwined, that the jury had in front of them, without a lot of instruction on these particular issues, what to do with it. They had circumstantial evidence rebutting, you know, discrepancies in direct evidence that he entered the home. They had the impeachment with the extra felonies and this idea that defendant's not trustworthy, you can't believe what he's saying, so you can't believe his exclusion or his explanation. They had a focus, a pervasiveness in the closing about this fleeing idea, the idea being he was fleeing and therefore that's why he would have gone into the home to hide. And they didn't really, they didn't have any instructions on alternate theories. The jury didn't know that they had to not only decide he went in, but there was no other rational hypothesis.
Wasn't his testimony, though, that he was trying to elude the police?
Yes, on the unrelated
right.
charge. And so that's why these are intertwined. Had he known that this would happen with the felony convictions, he might have chosen not to testify, and the evidence of hiding wouldn't have been in the record.
From your perspective, did the jury understand what had happened there? I mean, there was this agreement, or not an agreement, but a decision that two would be allowed in, and then because of the way the question was asked, he was in effect misrepresenting his record because he didn't have just two, he had more than two. But I mean, it's understandable how that happened when there'd been this agreement to have two, right. But did the jury ever, was it ever explained to the jury what had gone on there?
No, I think the jury had no idea. I think that the lawyer did, well, first of all, I think the state's lawyer made attempts to minimize, right? They knew that this was a dicey area and they were trying to limit their questions. But those questions they asked were very powerful. The defense attorney tried to clean it up by saying, you know, why did you do this? And he said, that's what my paper said. But lay people, nobody but probably criminal lawyers are going to know what was really going on there. And that's why there was prejudice and we're asking for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Haley. Court will take the matter under advisement at this time then, and we will issue a decision on the matter within 90 days. Thank you.